Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'll be joined today by Robert Wright, who's been asking big questions for at least three decades, and his latest book is Why Buddhism is True, The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment. But first, after hosting and producing this show weekly for 17 years, I stepped away from recording new live interviews about 3 years ago. And since then, I've dug into the archives every weekend to stream one of the relevant earlier interviews on Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. And podcasts of years of interviews are available to listen to anytime, anywhere on iTunes, Podomatic.com, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, the same website. But following the election of Donald Trump, I cannot resist exploring the path forward in confronting him and his administration. First, as I do each week, I'm going to offer you some sites for information on how to actively participate in resistance and the movement toward the healthy progressive future. Indivisibleguide.com. Indivisibleguide.com is very strong and now has sort of local chapters, if you will, all over the country. OurRevolution.com, one word, is the one that grew out of the Bernie Sanders campaign. MoveOn.org, which has been around for years but has primarily been online activism, now is aligning itself and collaborating much more closely with on-the-ground grassroots resistance. FiveCalls.org gives you calls you need to make to your representatives. TownHallProject.com tells you when your local representatives are going to be doing town halls. And CourageCampaign.org is very strong in the state of California. And you can email me at TEMcNally@mac.com if you want this information or more about how to deal with the Trump administration. Okay, so I said I only started doing new interviews because of Trump's election. And clearly, all of the new shows I've done this year are pretty overtly political, from analysis or historical context to strategies and tactics of resistance and response. So what's with an interview about Buddhism? Well, right off the bat, let me say that today's guest, Robert Wright, was one of the first people I thought of interviewing when I decided to deal with the political realities we now face back at the start of the year, because I knew that he does not shy away from thinking or talking about things that matter, but also because his books and his online conversations deal in all sorts of ways with the human condition. In The Evolution of God, for example, he makes the point that, one of his early books, he makes the point that our conceptions of God change with political conditions. When the Jews were harshly enslaved, God was vengeful. When they lived in relative peace with their neighbors, God was more beneficent. So how does that play out in religion's contemporary influence on politics, whether in ISIS or America's evangelical right? How is it at play in American Christians' embrace of Donald Trump, a prodigal if there ever was one? In another book of his, Non-Zero, Wright contends that evolution and history move toward greater and greater non-zero sumness, which I translate as greater and greater cooperation, collaboration, win-win outcomes. So how does he explain the resurgence of win-lose outcomes in the racist, anti-immigrant, anti-environmental attacks of Trump and his base? I hope you can see where I'm going. Robert Wright looks at the real world through some deep-view, big-picture lenses, and that's how I hope to engage with him today. Having said that, we will also deal with the ideas in his newest book, Why Buddhism is True. Why did he need to write this book at this time, and what does he think it has to offer people who are trying to make sense and justice of contemporary politics, culture, and economics? Robert Wright is an intellectual activist, I believe, because of the big questions and the big conversations he's consistently seeking out and taking part in. His books include Three Scientists and Their Gods, Looking for Meaning in an Age of Information, The Moral Animal, Non-Zero, The Logic of Human Destiny, The Evolution of God, and his latest, as I said, Why Buddhism is True, The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment. He's also a senior fellow with the New America Foundation, teaches at Princeton University, and is co-founder and editor-in-chief of two websites that feature a lot of video pieces, Blogging Heads TV and Meaning of Life TV. So, welcome again, Robert Wright, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Well, thank you, Terrence. Great to be talking to you again.
Okay, you heard my introduction, Any response in terms of how you think of the arc of your own work or your personal path and how it relates to what we're doing?
Well, I guess of my past work, the book that maybe most directly relates to the current moment is Non-Zero, because it did talk about the trajectory toward greater and greater interdependence among nations, among peoples, and the attendant need for more in the way of global governance and cooperative policymaking to deal with problems that confront more than one nation and so on. Donald Trump stands pretty firmly in opposition to that basic drift. In fact, I'd say a lot of his political support came from stirring up resentment against those forces, so to speak. You mm-hmm. know, the people he calls, cosmopolitans or globalists. And it's not that he didn't raise any good issues. I mean, for example, the effects of trade on American workers is something that very much needs examining. But that's a case where I would look to global governance, or at least international agreements for the solution to the problem, rather than the kind of isolationism that he champions. And of course, you know, more broadly, I mean, he exploits xenophobia, just a general kind of aversion to things not American. So I think he's kind of a reaction against both the kind of drift of history identified in the book Non-Zero and my own view about what is the appropriate way to go in light of that drift, you know, how we should respond to the drift toward greater interdependence as people, as citizens, and so on. So I think something like him was bound to happen. You know, there was bound to be a backlash. There are a lot of genuinely unsettling forces at work. You know, globalization is a chaotic process in some respects, immigration is, changes things, and it gets people's attention, and it makes some people feel threatened. So it's not surprising that something like this would arise, and that's why you're seeing versions of it in other countries. This is not just a one-off, and so that's why I think we need to think about it broadly as something with its roots in fundamental trends, and figure out what to do about it, and look seriously at the grievances of the people who supported Trump. You know, I personally don't dismiss them all as bigots or as anything else. I think they actually have different motivations for voting for him. As it happens, three of my four siblings voted for Trump. So, not something I'm proud of.
But wow.
Something that allowed me to think about, furthered my thinking on this.
Wow. I talked to people before the election about an article that I read in The Guardian, which said millennials weren't behaving the way that, their liberal seniors hoped they would, in that many of them were moving toward Trump. And, you know, it was like an article. OK, but the comments in The Guardian, which I assume is a pretty literate, pretty intelligent audience, I was amazed at the number of comments said, "I'm voting for him to blow things up. I'm voting for him. Something has to change."
And yeah, one of my siblings said something like that.
Yep.
I want to throw a wrench into the works.
Yeah, yeah. Which I mean, I'm of the 60s. I know the sentiment. And of course, one of the comments just a short way down the path after this article was, "I did that in 68 and we got Nixon."
Right.
But there you go. Yeah, I think, by the way, one thing you mentioned, that the threats of globalization, I think paired with them are the threats of technological innovation, and that it's the
right.
Two together. One is easier to find an enemy, and the other one is, shall we say, easier to ignore, because it's
right.
I mean, I even read actually that Carrier, who Trump made that big deal of that he was saving jobs and that they were investing $16 million more dollars in their operations here. It turns out I read something yesterday. Lord knows if it was true. But I read something yesterday that said that all of that $16 million is going toward automation. You know, so there are
Exactly. Automation is an underrated force.
Yeah.
And I think most economists would say is it plays a bigger role in displacing Americans from their jobs than international trade does. But in any event, it's a big, big deal.
Right.
And it's something we need to think about.
And obviously something which we're not going to deal with much today, but which also, you know, just is ready for philosophical conversation. You know, right, as to what does this mean? Who are we? Who are they? What role do we and our inventions play in all of that? But we don't have time to go into that one today. One thing I wanted to do, Robert, was just start off with a couple of your earlier books to get people who might not be that familiar with your work familiar with it, but also because it lends some light on this. But the first one, the first book I found of yours was your first book, Three Scientists and Their Gods, and I wasn't aware when I discovered it of its prominence, that it was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize and so on, but I loved it, and I found it a wonderful introduction to some provocative approaches to worldviews. You wrote that in 88, which, as I place it, is really right at the emergence of the personal computer and the internet. When you look back at that now, look back at some of what you were talking about there, what those three scientists you talked about, what have you kind of thought about in reflection on that? Because the timing of it seemed very opportune.
Yeah, well, that was at the dawn of kind of the digital age almost. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had bought my first personal computer, which would seem incredibly crude by today's standards, a few years before the book came out, and I wrote the book on it. But for example, we weren't yet thinking of computers as communications devices.
That's right.
I don't think I used a modem on that particular computer. But I did have a sense when I wrote the book of how information technology seemed to fit into the very broad sweep of human history and, in a certain sense, all of organic history. I mean, I'd gotten interested in the ideas of this Jesuit mystic, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, who, I mean, whatever you want to say about his views of kind of how evolution works and so on, there's controversy over that. I mean, he was a paleontologist as well as a Catholic theologian, but writing back like in the early part of the 20th century, he said, you know, look, step back and look at this. We're building a global brain.
Yep.
You know, which he called the noosphere. I mean, this was before TV. He was saying this, you know, and I came to think that he was right. That if you looked at, you know, information technology and from broad perspective, that's what was going on, and you could almost view it, as he did, as the culmination of the growth in complexity that had started with the beginning of life and biological organization, right? So you've gone to multi-celled organisms, to societies of multi-celled organisms, and this one species, us, sets in motion a cultural, which includes technological evolution, that carries organization to higher and higher levels. You know, you get ancient city-states and so on, and here we are, on the verge of global community, and that is very much in that first book. Already then, I was starting to think that that our politics were going to need to adjust to this. You know, nations were going to have to cooperate in ways that to solve non-zero-sum problems, which is a theme I revisited in Non-Zero. Now, in between those two books came my book on evolutionary psychology, The Moral Animal, and I mention that because it's the one that hooks up most with the book I just wrote, the Why Buddhism is True book.
Right.
And the part of it that hooks up, trust me, I'm going to try to draw all this together. Just give me one more minute, Terrence.
I'm asking you to do a lot here.
When I wrote The Moral Animal about evolutionary psychology, I became aware of what an imperfect instrument the human brain is.
Mm-hmm.
Natural selection literally designed certain kinds of delusions into it, right? Like, it, because thinking of our enemies in particular ways, you know, or our rivals in particular ways, or our allies in particular ways, it helped get genes into the next generation during human evolution. Thinking about our enemies and our allies in those ways became part of human nature. And I think the ways we think about those things and some other things, including our own righteousness, tend to be warped. And if we're going to solve all these problems we're talking about, we're going to have to unwarp them. And one way, not the only way, but one way I think to facilitate that unwarping is meditation, mindfulness meditation in particular. So I got interested in that, and that accounts for the latest book, the Buddhism book. And one thing, you know, as I looked into that, into Buddhism, I realized that kind of tracks evolutionary psychology pretty closely, in the sense that evolutionary psychology says we weren't designed to always see the world clearly. We weren't designed to be happy. Natural selection doesn't care about either of those things. It just wants to get genes in the next generation. And these two ideas are fundamental to Buddhism, that we naturally have illusions, perceptual distortions. We naturally suffer. And if we want to stop suffering, and also if we want to quit making other people suffer, that is to say, if we want to become better people, we need to learn to see things more clearly, more, in a way, calmly, dispassionately. And that's what one thing that mindfulness meditation is about. So I'm a big... I don't think meditation is the only way to put ourselves in a frame of mind to start seriously addressing the problems we face, but I think it helps.
Mm-hmm. Very good. And let's now go to one of the other books, which was Non-Zero.
Right.
So for folks, The Moral Animal lays out the evolutionary psychology, which I, as you said, why Buddhism is true, somewhat is built upon, you know. But Non-Zero makes another case about a direction to evolution, a direction to organic evolution, and a direction to human evolution that, as I said, I think it moves in the – you believe it moves in the direction of zero-sumness, which is – more cooperation, collaboration, complexity.
Yeah,
certainly.
Yeah, non-zero sumness.
Yeah.
A non-zero sum game being a game that, in principle, can have a win-win outcome or a lose-lose outcome if you misplay it. Sorry,
right.
Go ahead.
Right. And so that one, I remember, you know, the feeling was, you know, the feeling of reading it, and I assume the feeling as writing it, was fairly optimistic. You know, wow, I can see this. I can see us moving. Now, as you said when we were first talking about Trump, is that even if that is the fact that we have hit this bump in the road that is difficult and in many ways very dangerous, is not unexpected. That when one talks about evolution or any sort of thing that seems to be moving in a direction, you're obviously going to have resistance at moments. I would assume that's true in most physical mm-hmm. things, and it's certainly true in this one. So your take on, and you say very early in the new book, actually, that tribalism is the threat, or tribalism is a major threat. Could you talk about... kind of as, you know, you've put a lot of work and study and everything into seeing this, and as you begin to see the resistance manifest itself so strongly, your thoughts?
Yeah, so...
And not just about Trump, but more about this tribalism notion.
Sure, sure. Non-Zero is an optimistic book. You're not alone. Almost everyone said that, and in fact... it was depicted as more optimistic than I felt it was, and for that reason, I mean, I actually changed the paperback a little. So the hardcover came out at the very end of '99, and there was something I'd said in the book that I thought needed to get more attention, which is that, yes, I feel it's basically been inevitable, as an inevitable byproduct of technological evolution, that we would get to the brink of forming a global community, I did not consider it inevitable that we would succeed. So I revised the paperback to make it a little clearer that I consider this a kind of a moment of truth. And, mm-hmm. and in fact, there are reasons to think that although technology had pushed us to kind of higher and higher levels of social organization, you know, starting with hunter-gatherer village, the reasons to think that might not continue at the global level, because for one thing, one congealing force, one thing that always held societies together is an enemy. Is, you know, and at the global level, you don't have an enemy in the traditional sense unless, you know, you get, like, you know, you see invaders from Mars or something. Now, you do have enemies in a sense, like
climate change.
Global warming
yeah.
is a common enemy, but it doesn't have the same viscerally galvanizing effect just because of the way human nature is. I mean, it doesn't have the same galvanizing effect as an actual human enemy.
Right.
And so anyway, right, at this particular crossroads, I do think the great enemy is what you could call the psychology of tribalism. Natural selection did design the human mind to, among other things, engage in group conflict, apparently. And the psychological equipment that helps us engage in that conflict includes real distortions, you know, distorted perceptions of how right we are and how wrong the other group is, and things like that. And the distortions are really subtle, and they drive, you know, people like may have heard, for example, of confirmation bias, where you only notice or cling to information that accords with your pre-existing view, and you don't notice or reject information that seems in opposition to your worldview. So that's a cognitive bias that I think is part of the psychology of tribalism. There are other ones. They are subtle, and I think it doesn't matter which kind of conflict you're talking about. It's the same mechanisms. It may be sectarian conflict, Sunni versus Shia. It may be political polarization in America. It may be war between nations. It's the same set of psychological mechanisms. And one point in the Buddhism book, the latest book, is that all these biases, and I can talk about others, these cognitive biases, are very subtly driven by feeling, by affect. In other words, cognitive bias is kind of a misnomer,
mm-hmm.
right? So even confirmation bias, I mean, you see this when any of us plays a role in spreading so-called fake news, and I think most of us have played a role. I know I have sometimes retweeted something without really examining the document that I was ultimately promulgating. And the reason I do it is because it feels good to believe it's true. Like,
mm-hmm.
I can tell, like, the claim in this document is going to reflect badly on my ideological enemies. That feels good. It's going to reflect well on my own ideological tribe. That feels good. So you click retweet without really examining it. So although confirmation bias is called a cognitive bias, it's really feelings that are driving it. And one thing I like about mindfulness meditation is it makes you more aware of how feelings are subtly guiding your behavior. So basically, I think, you know, one way to put the great to describe the great challenge humanity faces is to talk about kind of the cognitive biases that constitute the psychology of tribalism. And I think we are all subject to them to one extent or another, which isn't to say they are equally present on both sides of every divide, but I think we could all stand to improve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I recently interviewed Michael Lewis on the book The Great Undoing,
mm-hmm.
which basically the book is about all of these cognitive biases and the way we delude ourselves. One of the things you said very early in your answer to that last question, Robert, I wanted to go back to just for a second, in which you said that we lack a common enemy. Globalization lacks a common enemy, and so in some sense it becomes the enemy for some people. And I think what I wanted to draw attention to was that in Non-Zero, you suggest that the greatest oppositional situations create a great deal of cooperation. That is to say, war, while mm-hmm. it pits two, let's say, the Allied powers against the Axis powers, within the Allied powers or within the United States, nothing can do as much to bring people together. And that's sort of what you meant when you said this lack of a common enemy in globalization is what makes it's kind of puts us in new territory, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's a common thing to say is right after 9/11, America was, you know, it hasn't been that unified since then because it seemed like a great external threat. And of course, what Trump does to galvanize his tribe and consolidate his tribe is to find a bunch of enemies. And you know, they include globalists, cosmopolitans, immigrants, feminists, whoever.
Well, even
you know, he's good at that, and that's why he's dangerous because he has such a sense for kind of the dark parts of human nature and how you exploit them. I mean, if you can convince people that they have an enemy, then a particular set of cognitive biases will get triggered, and then they will view the enemy through those lenses, and that will shape the way they process, you know, all the information that's coming in. But that's why kind of our side faces such a rhetorical challenge, right? We can't. It's part of our ideology, I hope, that you don't play that game, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you don't. And I will say, you know, this is why I don't want to get into this too much, but you know, there was a division kind of among anti-Trumpers on this Russia thing, on how heavily to exploit, you know, the seeming connection between Trump and Russia. And I think one reason some people on our side were uneasy about that, I mean, Glenn Greenwald and me to some extent, is just whenever you start, you know, accusing someone of associating with foreign people that being the big indictment, I always get a little uncomfortable because that impulse has been misused so often.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as it happens, I think there's more and more evidence that something kind of weird was going on with Trump and Russia in some sense. But so it's not like that's an illegitimate avenue. But this points to the challenge we face.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can't say to Trump supporters, wait a second, the enemy isn't the globalists. The enemy is this other group of people. The enemy isn't the immigrants. The enemy is this other group of people.
Right.
There's no other group of people we want to point to, right, and demonize. So that makes it a very difficult challenge.
Yeah. And the other piece, by the way, in the very end stages of the election campaign, as far as I could tell, the Democratic campaign, the Hillary Clinton campaign, was focusing much more on the enemy, that is to say Trump, and the fear of Trump's unfitness than they were any sort of positive future. And,
that's right.
And while it worked great for him, it didn't work so well for them.
No, that's right. I mean, people said Trump was appealing to fear. The Clinton campaign was largely about appealing to fear.
Absolutely.
Of Trump.
Absolutely.
And now I happen to think that was a legitimate fear, as we're seeing. But on the other hand, you would like the candidate to be proposing something positive to solve some of the problems that Trump was exploiting.
Right. And
he's not dreaming all these problems up.
The other thing I would say is that his audience, his base, was much more likely to be motivated to make sure they made it to the polls based on the fears he was raising than her audience was. Was just not as motivated by the fear of Trump. And I think, you know, you got to also take into account who you're working with.
Right.
And how susceptible they're going to be.
I agree. And let me give you an example of something that continues to be discussed virtually not at all, so far as I can tell, on the left. And this is something I emphasized in Non-Zero, and in other writings, but it's that, you know, there is such a thing as a left-wing trade agreement, okay? The choices are not between trade agreements with countries and the kind of economic isolationism that Trump is proposing, you can imagine trade agreements that have truly significant labor and environmental accords. Now, we've had trade agreements with labor and environmental accords, but that's largely been a kind of a token thing. I mean, there's, especially in the labor front. I mean, you know, and I would just like to imagine, like, what kinds of things could you in principle have in a labor agreement? You could say, well, if a low-wage country wants to have a trade agreement with us, they have to legalize unionization if unionization is not legal. Or, in the extreme case, they have to even agree to a minimum wage. Now, that's going to sound crazy to most people, well, in the world, because nobody ever talks about it. But and traditionally, you know, the kind of people in corporate America who contribute so much money to campaigns on both the Democratic and Republican sides have so fiercely rejected any this kind of talk that no one ever took it seriously. But I think Trump illustrates that, look, you may have to choose between trade agreements that are more left-wing than any trade agreements we've ever contemplated and all hell breaking loose, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if the only way, you know, I mean, this is what I would say to people in corporate America. If the only way to convince a lot of workers in middle America that trade itself is not the enemy is to get really creative in the structure of trade agreements, then maybe you should experiment with that and actually build in some things that truly would buffer American workers from low-wage competition to at least some extent.
You know, this will sound like a digression, but in some interviews and some work I've done comparing us to European countries, in Germany, if you have a corporation with more than 2,000 employees, half of the board has to be elected by the workers.
Right.
There are things that you can do
right,
to give the workers more voice, to make the workers give them a seat at the table, to make them share in both the pain, but also in the benefits. And I don't even see progressives in America doing any kind of a decent job of actually pushing those sorts of things. That could be in a trade agreement. I mean,
no, you're right. There's very little creative discussion in general. In fact, you know, back when Steve Bannon was still part of the administration, he was pushing.
Yes, he was.
A more progressive income tax.
Yep.
He was within the administration. He was apparently arguing for higher tax rates on the rich. And I just thought, man, if he beats the Democrats, I mean, if he sells Trump on this, and
yeah,
Trump basically beats the Democrats to the punch on this, I give up. You know, but because remember, I mean, this is in the partisan context, in terms of the structure of American parties, one of the prospects raised by Trump has been a fundamental party realignment where, you know, a lot of, workers, you know, middle American workers who might have traditionally been Democrats, perhaps by virtue of union affiliation or whatever, move to the Republican Party, and the Republican Party changes its character. And it becomes the party that taxes rich people and is suspicious of elites, and that was kind of Bannon's hope.
Yeah.
And I just think Democrats need to be thinking about the thing in that broad a context. You know, the Trump signifies that we need to rethink things.
And by the way, one name we haven't mentioned here since I did it early on, talking about an organization that grew out of his campaign, is Bernie Sanders.
Look, I think he could have won.
So
I mean, I think he would have had a better chance than Hillary.
So do I.
Because he was speaking to the issues, and he was speaking with conviction, and he doesn't seem like just another politician. We also shouldn't underestimate how much of this was just a revolt against the political class.
Absolutely. No,
Trump didn't seem like a politician. That's one thing you can say about him, is he doesn't seem like a politician.
And you know what? To most people, neither does Bernie Sanders.
Well, but I think, that's right. Oh, yeah, exactly.
I'm saying
exactly.
As a positive.
And Hillary does.
As a positive.
That was that was the perception.
Yeah. And the other thing, I mean, you know, when I looked at, there were two candidates drawing 20 crowds of 25,000. That's a very good indicator of whether you're going to have passion when it comes time for get out the vote.
Absolutely.
And that was ignored.
There's been work done on Trump voters, kind of anthropological work, so to speak, you know, social sciences going out into Trump land and interviewing them. And some of them have found that a lot of people who voted for Trump were fairly sympathetic to Sanders.
Yep. Okay. One question about the evolution of God. In the evolution of God, another book that I highly recommend folks get, you talk about what you call the changing moods of God, arguing that religion is adaptable and it's based on the political, the economic, the social circumstances of the culture that it's taking place in rather than strictly based on scripture. One of the things, how do you see that playing out in religion's contemporary influence on politics, whether in ISIS or America's evangelical right? What is driving them to have a vengeful God and a vengeful religion?
Well, I think, as usual, it's the perception of an enemy. I mean, in the case of ISIS, and in general, kind of radical Islam, it is very much aided and abetted by the perception that there are enemies of Islam and that the United States is one of them. And we've, blundered into kind of encouraging that perception, certainly not starting with, but certainly including the war in Iraq, without which ISIS would not exist, by the way.
Yep.
I mean, and now, unfortunately, Trump is associated with a lot of people, including himself, who talk in a way that encourages the perception that America is at war with Islam. Steve Bannon virtually agreed, and still does, though he's not part of the administration anymore, with that. You know, he had this kind of clash of civilizations worldview. On the Christian right, there is the perception of an enemy that Trump kind of exploited, and there the idea is that the enemy is kind of, well, broadly speaking, I mean, certainly includes these kind of cosmopolitan elites who have a different value system and who are thought to hold people like them in contempt. And by the way, this is one reason I'm not a big fan of the new atheists.
Mm-hmm,
I think in general,
mm-hmm.
I'm not opposed to atheism.
Right.
It's just that when part of your mission to be going around and preaching to everyone about how stupid they are to believe in God, you know, that's only going to bring out the most radical elements. I think one thing that would be good in this context is just to be, well, just not convey the idea that we hold people in contempt, generally.
Yeah, exactly.
In general, not just the religious part.
Right, right. Thrive, no.
Driven largely by the perception that we hold them in contempt. And I have, I've just started this thing called Mindful Resistance. It's at mindfulresistance.net, which it is connected to my book, my Buddhism book, and to mindfulness meditation, but it isn't only for people who meditate. The broad point is, we need to be careful and strategic in dealing with Trump. And sometimes we overreact to his provocations in ways that strengthen his base. And we need to be aware that when we express anything that can be as construed as contempt for his base, and start talking as if, well, they all must be racist, or they all must be this, or they all must be stupid, that empowers him. And broadly what we're doing there is encouraging a mindful approach to resisting Trumpism in just the everyday kind of traditional English sense of the term mindful, which is to say careful,
yeah,
attentive,
yep,
calm, but determined. And that's actually very much the mindset that mindfulness meditation cultivates, I think. I mean, it isn't, I'm not talking about you know, using meditation to suffuse the world in brotherly love, I mean, that would be great. And there actually are forms of meditation designed to cultivate love, but mindfulness meditation is more about clarifying the mind, making you aware enough of your feelings that you're not overreacting to things like Trump. And so, and it isn't just that overreaction empowers his base, it's that it distracts us from addressing the problems we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
We need to think seriously about the challenges posed by globalization,
yep,
about how Trump supporters react to immigration, about why they feel disrespected and ignored, and so on. And we need we can't get too distracted by Trump's, you know, ongoing reality show. So what, you know, people at mindfulresistance.net, they can sign up for the weekly newsletter. We've just started it. It's evolving. I've only been doing it for a couple of weeks. And I encourage people to try mindfulness meditation. I think that'll help. But it's not only for people who do that.
Okay. This is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Robert Wright, who's been asking big questions for at least three decades. His latest book is Why Buddhism is True, The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment. You can learn more at mindfulresistance.net. That's one word, mindfulresistance.net, or meaningoflife.tv and bloggingheads.tv. Okay, let's turn to the new book, Why Buddhism is True. For folks who don't know, what is Buddhism? How do you define it?
Well, I'm focusing on what's sometimes called the naturalistic part of it. In other words, this isn't about reincarnation or karma, which is a big part of Buddhism as it's actually practiced in Asia. I mean, you know, Buddhism in Asia is a religion in very much the way we think of religions. I mean, they pray for things, and they believe that ethical conduct can help them in the afterlife in the sense of a favorable rebirth and so on. And in fact, most of these Buddhists don't meditate. I mean, Westerners associate Buddhism with meditation. In Asia, that's done mainly by monks, and not all monks meditate. But there has been, alongside the growth of Buddhism as a religion, has been a very well-developed philosophy and a psychology, a conception of human psychology, whose logic stands independent of the religion. So you can address it kind of separately. And it is the part of Buddhism that has become so big in the West, you know, in what some people call Western Buddhism, which involves meditation in the context of Buddhist philosophy. But certainly, I'd say one thing I'm defending when I say, you know, why Buddhism is true. I mean, by the way, I know that is a title that is so ambitious and arguably grandiose that it could be taken as obnoxious. I understand that as a reaction to the title. But what I mean by why Buddhism is true, what I'm saying is true, is the essential Buddhist, first of all, the diagnosis of the human predicament, which is this. Buddhism says that the reason we suffer and the reason we make other people suffer is because we don't see the world clearly. We are subject to certain delusions. If we clarify our visions, we can suffer less and we can also become better people. So it's kind of an amazing claim, the idea that these three things would align, right? The pursuit of truth would also nourish happiness and nourish good behavior, you know, moral, get you closer to moral truth. That's an amazing claim. I am arguing that it's true, and I'm defending not just the Buddhist prescription, but the Buddhist diagnosis, which includes meditation, in particular mindfulness meditation, which is a very, you know, goes back to very ancient Buddhist texts. Although the nature of mindfulness meditation has changed in certain ways that I talk about in the book, but it's still fundamentally connected to its Buddhist philosophical roots. So I'm defending all that. I'm defending it partly in the context of evolutionary psychology because, as I mentioned earlier, natural selection did not design the mind to always see the world clearly. We have delusions about ourselves, about other people in particular, and it didn't design us to always be happy. In fact, in a certain sense, natural selection designed us to be recurringly discontented, to always want more. And this is the source of the kind of, you know, the quest for more and more in the way of acquisition, accomplishment, mm-hmm. status, that gets us into trouble sometimes. It's kind of, the quest is built into us by natural selection, but that doesn't mean we can't transcend it. And one of the virtues of the Buddhist prescription is it very, very much recognizes that as being a problem and gives us a practice that helps us deal with it. So in a nutshell, that's what the book is about.
Right. Let me just mention a couple of things that come up for me. One is an example you use, but an example often used if people are trying to get this sense of this, the way that we delude ourselves. And you point out very much that when we evolved, when many of these cognitive impulses and behaviors evolved, we were in a society where they made sense. If you were alone on a path, it would be fine if you mistook that movement to your right as a snake 99 times wrong, but it saved your life the 100th time.
Right.
Now, and as you point out, in current society, those kinds of anxieties and fears have been pointed out to the way someone looks at you. And that is not nearly so evolutionarily positive as it was
right.
to mistake the stick for a snake. Another thing I believe you say is that this whole thing of looking at how these things that served us at one point don't serve us today. That's a great big part of it. Let me just mention to you, I know one thing I was going to say is that one thing I noticed, and see if this is exactly your perception of it too, is that what's interesting in this book is that on the one hand, you use evolutionary psychology, science, as sort of half of your examination, and I'd say your own personal subjective experience as the other half. And it's kind of you're taking both of those things into account to make your argument. Would that be correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, I had always had trouble meditating. I'd never gotten into it. I finally, in 2003, went to a meditation retreat in kind of a last gasp effort to kind of get the idea with meditation. And it really worked, and it was an amazing experience. And since then, I've gone to a number of retreats, and I now have a daily meditation practice. And so, yeah, I am not nearly as accomplished a meditator as some of the people I interviewed for the book and talk about in the book. But between having a daily practice and especially going on these retreats where you can really reach significant meditative depths, I've gotten a sense for the kinds of experiences that people have who have invested a lot of time. And that has given me, I hope, some insight into the meaning of some of these kind of deep-sounding Buddhist concepts like not-self, the claim that the self doesn't exist and our conception of ourself is in some ways illusory, or the concept of so-called emptiness, which is the idea that when we look out in the world and see things, they actually don't have essence in the sense that we think of them as having essence. And by the way, that last thing I think is super important in terms of addressing some of the problems we've been talking about. Because one kind of essence we project is...
Stereotypes,
you know,
right?
Is what?
Stereotypes.
Yeah, I mean, the Buddhist idea of emptiness. I mean, here's an experience I had on a retreat that I think was an experience of emptiness. I was walking along, and I saw through the woods, and I saw a weed called a plantain weed that I had spent a lot of time trying to kill in my lawn. I didn't use chemicals. I dug them up one by one. And all of a sudden, this is like 5 days into a retreat, after which, you know, your consciousness is in a very different place than normally, and I just went like, why have I been, you know, this weed is as beautiful as all the other things in the forest. There's no objective criterion for distinguishing what we call weeds from other forms of life, you know. And I know it's one thing to just make the point that there's no objective criterion for this distinction, but this was more than that. It was a deep shift in my perspective. And I realized that traditionally, you know, you accept the categorization of what we call weeds in a way that really subtly infiltrates your perception of them and infuses that perception with a certain kind of feeling, a certain kind of affect, And the experience of emptiness is to basically not accept the conventional categories. And where that becomes really consequential is with human beings. Because, you know, we're now learning that to see essence of enemy in someone is to trigger various cognitive biases that are going to make it very hard to ever recategorize them and, you know, and make your peace with them. And so, you know, this is, do I have time to talk about one kind of amazing cognitive bias that hasn't been discussed much?
Okay, and let me just, before you do, let me say why I said stereotype was because of that, that yes, you see a quick glimpse of someone and immediately lay out this whole set of categories that you've already defined them with in that split second. So that's why I said stereotype.
Absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, and the idea is that, of emptiness is these stereotypes really infiltrate our perception so subtly that we don't realize they're stereotypes. They're just part of our perceptual, our everyday perceptual machinery. So this cognitive bias, and I think this helps get us into wars, there's something called the fundamental attribution error. And originally the idea was this, about this particular bias, was that we tend to, in explaining people's behavior, we put too much emphasis on disposition and not enough on situation. So in other words, we see somebody being rude to a checkout clerk, and we go, that person's a jerk, rather than thinking, well, maybe they just got horrible news that they have a fatal illness, or maybe they just their spouse walked out on them, or whatever. We tend to assume that that behavior reflects on the essence of the person. Now, later study revealed that it's actually more subtle than that. With our friends and allies, if they do something good, we tend to attribute that to their disposition, to their essence. If they do something bad, we explain it away, like, oh, peer group pressure, they didn't get any sleep the night before, whatever. With our enemies and rivals, it's the opposite. They do something bad, and we say that's essence of them. They are bad. If they do something good, we say, oh, they're just like posing as good in order to get something or whatever. And I think this explains, with one reason at least, when people are proposing that we invade some country, they go to great lengths to demonize the leaders of the country. And often the leaders deserve it, maybe, but still, the point is that once they have convinced us that, once they put that leader in the enemy box, this cognitive bias I'm talking about is going to keep them there, because then anything bad they do will just reinforce the image of enemy. Anything good they do, we will explain away. And I really think if you ask, like, why, when Saddam Hussein had admitted weapons inspectors and let them inspect every facility they asked to inspect, which is a fact that is often denied, but is a fact, we didn't, you know, it was always like, this is trickery, this is trickery. We know he's hiding something because we've already put him in the enemy box.
And in the deception box as well. Let me go on from there, because we have very little time now. And I would say, by the way, when you say we, you mean we, those who were Dick Cheney and his folks.
I mean America, as a government.
That's right. There were many of us who didn't. Including
me, I'm happy to say. Yes.
Right. Let me offer something just as for folks who are kind of playing with this meditation and mindfulness piece. And this is, I myself was introduced to meditation back in 71 when I took up yoga. And it didn't take, and I did it while I was at a yoga camp for a couple of months. I did it every day, but then I didn't continue until 1985, when I was in the beginnings of a divorce and my career was going well, but overwhelmingly so, you know. I did it off of Herbert Benson's book, The Relaxation Response, because it was so damn practical. And now I have done it. But one of the things that I noticed, and that when people are thinking about it, I tell them this: I believe there's a message inherent in something as simple as the focus on the breath. Because notice I say the breath and not my breath, because no matter what your philosophical, psychological, religious interpretations of reality might be, you're focusing on something that you share, not only with other human beings, but with all other creatures, with plants, and even with all that came before or will come after. The thing you are focused on when you focus on the breath is essential to your existence, but it's transitory, and it flows within and without you. I think that, you know, as much as people just look, that focus on the breath is kind of to have something to look at. I think the message of that is deep and deeply helpful.
That's a good way to look at it. I mean, it's certainly true that with mindfulness, the typical way to start kind of stabilizing your mind is by focusing on the breath. And that's a tradition that goes way back,
yep,
before Buddhism. And you know, the breath, you know, I think in, you know, Hindu philosophy that precedes Buddhism, I believe the breath is accorded a kind of profound significance, you know, maybe somewhat of the kind that you're attributing to it. But I think, you know, I think beyond that, I mean, I'm going to say something that may sound a little different, but I think it's related, is that one of the ideal end results of mindfulness meditation is to realize how much you have in common,
yes,
with other people, to acquire enough kind of distance, in a certain sense, from yourself, to do a good enough job of observing your own mind, and to remove enough of the kinds of distortions that impede your view of other people's behavior, to realize that fundamentally people everywhere are driven by the same set of concerns and insecurities and so on, and very often the behavior that we find abhorrent and may genuinely need to change in other people or ourselves boils down to these kind of basics of human nature, and kind of the more calmly we can observe that and think about how to deal with it, the better.
Okay, I'm gonna give you one last question. By the way, the book goes way beyond what we've talked about, and I just want to give it that comment before I ask you this last question, and that is that although we've been talking about sort of the initial stages, Robert does deal with the fact that Buddhism doesn't just want you to be mindful in the moment, but it also promises enlightenment, realization of whole new perceptions and so on. And the book deals with that. We're not taking much time to deal with it. I'm going to go to the quote that you have from Walpola Rahula, a Buddhist monk, in 59, published a book called What the Buddha Taught, in which he says that the false notion of the self produces harmful thoughts of me, mine, selfish desire, craving, attachment, etc. He says it is the source of all the troubles in the world, from personal conflicts to wars between nations. To this false view can be traced all evil in the world, the false notion of the self. Here's your last question. You say, if saving the world depends on a big chunk of humanity having this experience, we may be in for a long wait.
Right, but I'm happy to say that I don't think saving the world does require a big chunk of humanity having what's called the full-on not-self experience. One of the points of the book is that even if you're doing a kind of like therapeutic version of mindfulness meditation, stress reduction, dealing,
yep,
with anxiety,
yep,
I think you're closer than you realize to exploring at least somewhat more deeply really profound Buddhist concepts like not-self. And it's not just a matter of like meditating and meditating for years, hoping you finally suddenly cross that threshold toward what's called not self, and the bounds of the self dissolve and you feel continuity with everyone and you're forever changed. I'm making the argument that you can kind of make incremental progress toward that by letting go, ceasing to identify with certain problematic parts of yourself, ranging from anxiety to rage, and in the process, dropping the things that separate you from identifying with other people and other living things. And even if you don't get all the way to full enlightenment, and I think very, very few people can hope to get that way in the deepest Buddhist sense, you can make real progress. And what's needed to save the world is that more and more people just take that challenge seriously and recognize some of the distortions built into us by natural selection, including this obsession with ourselves and our stories about ourselves and acquiring more and more things for ourselves, and so on. I think, you know, just earnest intention combined with meditation can do a lot to help the world, whether or not any of us ever,
right,
attain full enlightenment.
Very good. And I want to, I'm gonna wrap up now, but I do want to commend to people an article in Wired. Is mindfulness meditation a capitalist tool or a path to enlightenment? Yes. which you can find at wired.com, and it really goes in deeper into a lot of what we've touched on in the second half of this
show.
Yeah,
that's an adapted excerpt, and it does capture one of the central arguments in the book pretty concisely, yeah.
Absolutely. So again, the websites are Meaning of Life TV, Blogging Heads TV, and MeaningfulResistance.net. The book is Why Buddhism is True, The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment. Thank you, Robert Wright. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Terrence. Your work is really important, so you keep it up too.
Thank you. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. That's one word, a world that just might work. They're the same website. If you want to receive weekly email announcements telling you who's going to be on, and what we're going to talk about, and whenever I put a new podcast up, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the free forum podcast on iTunes. You can find years of podcasts at my site. Listen anytime, anywhere. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, etc. Thanks to G, my engineer, and to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely.